There's a place in New York where you can walk through the actual front doors of the world's most famous recording studio, Abbey Road. Through those doors, past the Beatles, Pink Floyd, Radiohead, and countless other rock giants. Where can you find those doors? At the Hard Rock Cafe Times Square. The Abbey Road doors and thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock Cafes, Hard Rock Casinos, and Hard Rock Hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Stephen's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
Mighty Manfred with you once again for our Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock and Little Stephen's Underground Garage. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow and subscribe, rate, and review. Joining me today is Greg Cartwright, singer, songwriter, and frontman for Asheville, North Carolina's Raining Sound. Prior to that, he was in two seminal Memphis, Tennessee bands, The Oblivions and The Compulsive Gamblers. He's also produced or played with The Deadly Snakes and The Detroit Cobras. And other production duties include the Shangri-La's lead singer Mary Weiss' comeback album of 2007 called Dangerous Game, that Greg also supplied most of the songs for. Before we start our chat, we'll take a listen to some of the Raining Sound song Straight Shooter off the 2002 album Time Bomb High School. And then I'll be back on the line with Greg Cartwright for our Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Stephen's Underground Garage.
That you can hurt, shoot that make you cry. It will break you down and make you wish it was alive.
This is the Mighty Manfred, and with me on the line today is singer, songwriter, musician, and producer Greg Cartwright. He's a driving creative force behind the Raining Sound, who began in Memphis, Tennessee, but have been based in Asheville, North Carolina for a number of years now. Prior to that, he was in seminal bands like The Oblivions and The Compulsive Gamblers. His side projects and producing roles have led him to work with the likes of Shangri-La's singer Mary Weiss on her 2007 comeback Dangerous Game, as well as having stints in The Deadly Snakes, Detroit Cobras, and The Parting Gifts, the latter along with Coco Hames of The Etts. Hey, Greg, how are you?
Manfred, I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm hanging in there, man. You are in Asheville, North Carolina, right?
I am.
So how are things there with your family and friends as far as the COVID thing goes?
Everybody's healthy right now, and we're doing the best that we can to kind of keep our pod of people in contact. And, you know, that's one of those things that it really is a challenge, because I have a teenager. You know, it's that time. This would be her senior year. So it's such a social time. I'm sure you remember what that was like in high school. That's like when you're really creating your identity and really kind of forming bonds that might go on into your 20s and 30s. And so I think if anything, it's more trying for her than it is for us. Esther and I are pretty, we're homebodies anyway. So that's easy, but it's time to make it so that she can have something that resembles something normal is the real tricky part.
Well, I have a daughter that has just gone off to college this fall. So her graduation and all of her senior activities were, you know, muted by the virus. So I know completely can feel your pain. And fortunately, she went to Cal Poly, and she's in a dorm there, and she's like the only kid in this four-person room. So she's in there with four mini fridges. I don't think she's really taken advantage of that yet, though. But yeah, I completely see what's going on there with your oldest daughter. And good luck to her for the rest of the year. And I hope that when we come out of this, maybe she can have some more normal sort of graduation things going on.
Exactly. And I wish your daughter the best of luck as well. And it is a roller coaster of emotions,
yeah,
for kids and their parents right now. And I think that is exacerbated to some degree by social media and all these other things. They can't get out of the house. You know, it's not as important for kids of this generation to learn how to drive, because we did that so that we could get away from our parents and get closer to our friends. But they have the internet as that vehicle. But unfortunately, the internet has all kinds of pitfalls, and it'll sap your dopamine. It'll do all kinds of crazy stuff to your head. So that being the outlet for everyone right now during this pandemic is kind of a double-edged sword, you know.
Right. Well, look, we have known actually each other for a number of years. Our various bands have played together. But those conversations, you know, were in the midst of shows and touring. That stuff is generally pretty brief. So as I was preparing for our chat, I realized, you know, I don't really know that much of your personal story outside of your bands being from Memphis. So are you native to the city?
I am. I grew up in a part of town that used to be its own area. It's North Memphis, and it's called Frazier, and it's kind of a small town atmosphere there. It's just a little north of Memphis proper, and there's a lot of farmland out there. Some of it is very rural. It was the home to the harvester plant, which is where most people in my family, when I was growing up, worked at the harvester plant. My dad worked at the Firestone plant. But a lot of that, the factory stuff that was out that way is all gone now. Of course, Harvester many years ago. But yeah, that's the area of town that I grew up in. And then by, you know, my late teens, I was in Midtown Memphis, which is like someplace I always wanted to be. You know, I wanted to be away from this kind of little small town atmosphere and more where the music was and the clubs were and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, Frazier has its own backstory that's kind of interesting as far as rockabilly and all that kind of stuff from Memphis. There were a lot of those guys came from that area. But yeah, I grew up there.
So you grew up there, and then you said for the last couple of years of high school, you went to a different high school?
I did. I started going to Central High School that was right in Midtown, almost to downtown Memphis. And I got into that school, which was a city school, through their arts program. They had an advanced placement arts program for people that were at college level art. And they had a really great art teacher. Through that program, I got to go into a city school inside town. I was at a city school where I was in Frazier as well. But yeah, the on the cover of Time Bomb High School, those pictures, and the cover of Home for Orphans are pictures of us at the high school I went to in Frazier High School.
Well, what's funny here is when picked up that you had gone to a different high school, I was going to say, was that Time Bomb High School? Was that like going, you know, having to switch or going to the high school, different environment? And then you kind of, you know, as we already talked about, the girls having these emotional sort of roller coasters, we're all dingled our adolescence in those years. But it seems like you were going to the art school, so this was all a good thing, or was that kind of wrapped up in the passion of learning and figuring out who you were at the time?
That was a rough time for me, and eventually I got to go to Central, but I did not graduate. I was having, you know, me and my parents weren't getting along, and at 17 I dropped out of high school and got a job. I had a friend that was a couple years older than me. We got an apartment together. So I've always had this sort of like fantasy life around high school, about what high school means and how wonderful it would be to make it to your senior year and experience all this stuff. So I've always had like, I collect records, like 45s that are about high school or a high school experience. Has always been something of a fetish for me. And I think it's because I never concluded that part of my life the way that other people do. So I had like always this part of my brain was reserved for a fantasy about it. And I think I kind of came full circle with that when I wrote Time Bomb High School, because that was my high school song. I didn't make it about my high school experience, though. I think I finally was able to put it all out of my mind by trying to write about my son's high school experience, who was heading into high school at that point in time, because the song is all about the modern high school experience of computers and school shootings and, you know, just all this crazy stuff. What a different, I thought high school was so bad I couldn't continue with it when I was 17. But I can't even imagine what it would be like now.
That's interesting. So with your, you mentioned, we talked about our daughters and the pandemic happening and how their graduations are affected and these sort of senior year things that are interrupted. But you were able to sort of vicariously experience these high school things through your son. Did he complete high school?
He did. And then he went to college, and I mean, I'm so lucky because I have three kids. Ruby is just turned 17. My oldest son is 28, and then my son in the middle is 22, and they all had, you know, a good high school experience as far as, you know, making good grades, making it all the way to the end, and then trying to do some learning after high school as well. And my fingers crossed that, you know, everything goes well for Ruby and that, you know, on the other side of this winter, there might be some possibilities for her going to college and stuff next year. But she's already taken, it's amazing, the school where she goes to high school, when there was in-class learning, there is a college directly across the street from Asheville High School, and they have a program where you can take college classes there if you have the right kind of grades. So she would do some of her classes at school and then walk across the street and take college classes at a college and get college wow. credit.
And, oh, by the way, so Ruby was a second choice name for our daughter. So her name's Taya, but Ruby was the...
Oh, what a beautiful name.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, that's my grandmother's name. So according to Lou Reed, Jenny said she was just 5 years old. There was nothing happening at all. And then she hears rock and roll on the radio and her life is saved. So, number one, was there much music in your home growing up? And number two, when was your life saved by rock and roll?
Absolutely. Yes to both. There was a ton of music in my house. My dad had a big, big record collection and he had several siblings. So whenever I wasn't at home, I spent a lot of time with my grandmother because her husband was in Middle Tennessee most of the time taking care of his mother, who was still alive and owned a big farm. He was always there, worked, taking care of the farm. My grandmother was alone a lot. Both of my parents worked, so it was a natural fit that I spent a whole lot of time with my grandma. And all of my dad and his siblings, when they all moved on to their respective lives, you know, doing whatever they're going to do, they left all their stuff there from when they were kids. So all of their records were all there. And I had a 45 record player and would just go through all of their records and listen to all their records. And so that was huge. Both of the places that I spent most of my time when I was a kid, there were tons of records, and listening to music was a big, big part of what you did every day.
So what is the period of time these lot of records, but is this, you know, 50s and 60s records or is it, and when we say 50s and 60s, we mean artists like what?
Well, that was the thing. It's interesting. It's like all the hits, of course, the Kinks and the Beatles and some country stuff and pop stuff, Little Richard, Sam Cooke, you know, things that were popular when they hit a certain age. And the fun thing was that in that it was a very mixed bag of whatever was, you know, hip on the radio at that time, but also a lot of local releases like a Tommy Burke and the Counts or whatever, just a 45 that they may have found somewhere that they really got into that wasn't actually a hit, but, you know, to me was very powerful. For whatever reason they liked it, I liked it when I heard it. So, yeah, it was like, you know, most of Gene Vincent, things that were very predictable, lots of Elvis records and other small label Memphis records. So it was a real mixed bag of, you know, whatever they were into at that time. And then when I was at home, my dad's taste had grown out of that and we're moving into things that he was listening to in the 70s, which, you know, some of those artists that he liked in the 60s, the Stones, Harry Nilsson, but also weird kind of more progressive things that were happening, Ken Huey, wherever music was headed, because even as he entered his adult life, he was still way into music. He was still buying records every week, playing music all the time in the house.
And you, are you an only child?
No, I had, when I was about eight, I had a younger brother come along, Adam. But there was a long time, you know, 8 years, I got to be an only child.
So I was just thinking of you going through the records by yourself there. So when did you actually start playing music, playing an instrument?
That was probably, I was about 12 or 13. I really expressed interest in getting a guitar. And my parents kind of scrambled to get me something around Christmas. And it turned out that I had an uncle that had a guitar that he had gotten in 65. It was like a K or something. Mm-hmm. That he played a little for a year, and then he lost interest. And my grandmother was great about everything that the kids lost interest with. She would put it in the attic or put it in the closet. Why? There was so much, her house was so fun for me. It was still loaded with all this stuff.
Yeah.
So she pulled out the guitar and the amp that came with it, which still looked like brand new. And that's what I got for Christmas that year. It was under the tree. I didn't know that it was his until later. It had been in an attic for a while, and the neck had bent. It was nearly impossible to play. It looked perfect, but it was, trying to play it was just a beast, like trying to get the strings to go down. And I remember for that first month thinking, man, I'll never be able to do this. These people who play guitar must be like Herculean strength.
When did you figure out otherwise?
When I figured out otherwise, I went to, there was a pawn shop that was on my way home as I would walk home. Me and other friends who were interested in rock and roll and stuff would see the guitars hanging in the windows. And there was one that was like a Les Paul copy that looked just like the guitar that I'd seen Jimmy Page play or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it looked just like it, but it was a knockoff, you know, and it was like $75 or something like that, you know. And I remember eventually kind of working up the nerve to go in and ask if I could touch it or play it. And the guy handed it to me, and I made a chord, like a G chord or whatever, and it was just the easiest thing in the world. And thought, wow, this guitar is like really magical. Like, are all guitars like this? You know, I just thought, why Jimmy Page plays this guitar? Like, it's so easy. So I talked to my dad about it, and he said, unbeknownst to me, he knew the guy who owned the pawn shop. He said, yeah, we can go down there. And I used to cut grass in the summer. And so I put down $10 and continued to pay $10 on it. And, you know, every couple of weeks until it was paid off. But that was my first guitar, was the one that was my uncle's. But the first one that really got me playing was the Les Paul copy.
So you mentioned your dad knowing the guy in the pawn shop, and they kind of, he helps work out this deal, and he's obviously a big music lover. You also mentioned how, you know, you're having difficulties there with the folks, and you leave high school, kind of strike out on your own at 17. Were they supportive of your music endeavors, or was this some friction at home?
I think they were later very supportive. But I think at the time, the amount of energy that I was pouring into writing songs and trying to have a band, that was taken away from schoolwork. It was definitely all I could seem to focus on.
Yeah.
But there were all kinds of other things in my life and kind of trauma and stuff that led me to think that music was a great outlet for me.
Yeah.
And to the degree that that's all I wanted to do. And so I can understand from a parent's perspective that that's very concerning. It's a little scary, and it's bound to cause friction. At the same time, a lot of the reason that I loved music so much and saw music as such a great avenue for me to go down was it seemed extremely important to my dad. You know, it seemed like he elevated it to a level of importance in his life that made me think it was very important.
So you are in high school and you're starting to trying to form bands. Is that right?
It was. Yeah.
So you're there. You've got all this great sort of music resource that you're able to listen to. And some of that being, you know, Memphis artists. Were you at that young age, were you aware of the rich music heritage that the city has?
No, I was not at all. That didn't come till later. The thing was, is I loved all these old records, and I loved listening to we had a couple of great oldie stations there in town. And that kind of music is what really appealed to me. And, you know, I was also listening to contemporary stuff that my friends were listening to. That was the early days of rap, like the first wave of rap. And we were all listening to that and going to roller skating rinks and stuff on the weekend. So I had my head a little bit in both worlds, but the old music meant so much to me. I mean, I just immediately connected with it. And so I was, you know, getting into all of this music, but I didn't know until later that, you know, a good chunk of what I loved so much was actually created right there in my hometown. And that was just the research part of my music brain had not really kicked in until I was in my 20s.
So in both the Compulsive Gamblers and the Oblivions, you were with Jack Yarber. So how did you meet Jack, and what identified him as being a kindred soul?
I had a roommate at the time who played drums in a couple of bands in town, Terry Tate. And I was writing songs all the time, also working, and I wasn't in a band. And it was much harder trying to be an adult. I was probably 18 or 19 at that time. Mm-hmm. I'd just been out of my home a little while. And Terry, my roommate, said, you know, there's this guy I've met, Jack Yarber, who had his band just broke up, and he's looking to start a new band, and you guys should meet. You kind of have a similar thing going on. And I said, yeah, that'd be great. So through Terry, I think we went to a midnight movie all together. There was a theater in town that ran, you know, really kind of movies that most people did not want to see at midnight, and it was a $2 entrance, so it was a really fun kind of meetup type of place. We all hung out and we liked each other right away. I think that week we then got together and tried to play a little bit. And then we were like, yeah, we should start a band. We tried out a couple of drummers and finally like wound up playing with two people that lived in his building and started a little band. Within a couple of weeks of knowing each other, we made recordings together, which also blew my mind. Because I had no idea you could record songs at home. So Jack also introduced me to four track recording, and that also was just a total game changer. Then I became totally obsessed because I've been writing songs, but I had to write all the words down and then remember everything I was doing, try to play them regularly enough to kind of have so that I could maybe show them to some other people at some point. And this idea of just being able to instantaneously make a song and record it, you know, start to finish, I didn't know that was something that was possible. But also the thing was with Jack was that really took me to the next level as a songwriter and as a musician was when I played with Jack for the first time. I remember thinking, wow, this guy sounds, his voice is kind of like, I wonder who it is he's trying to sound like. Because at that time, at that age, everything in your music is really about emulating all these influences that you have, all these singers that you like and bands that you like, and you're kind of taking a little pinch of this and a little bit of that and trying to kind of build something that's your own, but something that people will like because it's easily identifiable as a certain genre or something. And when I heard Jack's songs, I thought, man, this music sounds so crazy. Who is it he's trying to emulate? Because I need to get some of these records. And then I realized he just sounded like him. And then once that kind of clicked in my mind, I thought, I got to figure out how to do that. Like, I got to find my voice the way he has. Because until that point, I didn't really know that was a possibility.
So with Jack, you're in the Oblivions and you're in the Compulsive Gamblers, and those kind of both bands kind of overlap time wise and stylistically to a degree. I think the Oblivions being more stripped down, trashier. An Oblivion song, though, I think that has like the hallmarks of quintessential Greg Cartwright songwriting is Bad Man. And it's on the Oblivions album, Popular Favorites. The Detroit Cobras would later cover it. Can you tell me some about that particular song, Bad Man?
Yeah, I wrote that song. My son Andrew was just a couple years old at that point, and he had a little toy xylophone. And I came up with the idea of the chords and the subject matter for the song. And I think all my guitars were at our rehearsal place. So I was using his little toy xylophone to hammer out the melody. And then by the time I got the guitars back over to the house, I kind of already come up with this melody. So I then figured out what the chords were and recorded that and made a little demo that was just an acoustic guitar, a vocal, and this xylophone. That version is what eventually came out on the Greg Oblivion and the Tip Tops record, and then got used in the Guitar Wolf movie.
The Wild Zero? Was that the Guitar Wolf movie, Wild Zero?
Yeah, it's in Wild Zero. There are two songs from that Tip Tops album that wound up in the Wild Zero movie, but the Bad Man, that version of the acoustic toy piano kind of version of Bad Man is my favorite. And then I didn't really know what to do with that at the time because it didn't sound much like an Oblivion song.
Right.
But then later we were in such a crunch for material for another record that I just started throwing all kinds of things into the mix.
Yeah.
And the way that we attacked the song, it did fit. But if you hear this Tip Tops version, you would never even think of, you know, playing it the way the Oblivions did. But that was what made the Oblivions fun, is that it was stripped down. You could take any song and plug it into that dynamic and it would instantly become something else.
Right.
And there was also the thing with the Oblivions was to be playful and have a sense of humor. And also it had to be simple because even though Jack and I were playing for a very long time, Eric Friedel had just bought an instrument. So he wanted to be in a band and we wanted to have a band with him because we were all friends, but we had to keep things simple enough that he could have a guitar part to play. And, you know, by the time the band was over, he had really progressed. But in the beginning, that was kind of the premise.
Jim Cole.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, a highlight to me of the Compulsive Gambler days is that track, Stop and Think It Over. It's on Crystal Gazing Luck Amazing. And later on, you know, that's one of the songs of yours that Mary Wise did, you guys did for her album. What's the genesis of that song?
That song, in the early Oblivions and in the Gamblers, I was still working on my songcraft. I think Jack's material from all that, from the Gambler stuff, is probably the best stuff. Because I was kind of a half-baked songwriter at that point, I think, still. Mm-hmm. And I got better as we kept doing it and did the Oblivions. But the Oblivion stuff is so tongue-in-cheek and kind of silly. The lyrics are meant to be funny, or even ironic, or, you know, it's its own kind of weird thing. But toward the end of the Oblivions and then at the end of the Oblivions, I met Esther. We eventually got married. But that really changed my outlook on songwriting. I think up until that point, I would always put on a costume or a character to sing a song. And I think when I met her, it unlocked a part of my brain that made me feel like it was okay to sing about myself on a more personal level, or experiences that I had, or kind of opening up to what made me tick as a person rather than just kind of creating a character.
And so that song, I mentioned Mary Wise doing it, you know, you produced that album, you supplied a lot of the material, but that's one that you guys did and you performed it like on the Conan O'Brien show. And then that's that same song, I don't know if the Hives have done a studio version of it, but you can look online. And have you heard their version?
I have. And we toured with them a couple of times and we would actually play it together. Sometimes Pele would come and sing it with us, and sometimes they would perform it and I would go and sing it with them when we did a couple tours together many years ago, I guess 10, 15 years ago now.
What I want to ask you about it was, can you think of, is there a reason that you know or can guess as to why it seems to resonate well with other artists?
I really wondered that. I don't know what it is about it. I think it's just a catchy song.
Yeah.
I think it's like it's just got a great hook for a chorus. My friend Eddie, who used to be in a band with Co and the Knockouts, he had a band called The Sights, and they recorded it as a 45. There was also a band that did a kind of more kind of countryfied version with a I'm spacing on the name of the band now, but this has been many years ago. And they had sort of a hit with it and got it licensed into a movie. It has had a lot of play, that song. I really, to be honest, I don't know what it is about it that is. I think it's just an emotion and a feeling that people can identify with.
So it's got to be pretty thrilling when someone else is doing one of your songs, right? You have an expression or a vision of a song, and then it gets interpreted through someone else's experience. You know, they're adding or subtracting to it. What do you think about that?
I love it. It's super flattering to know that someone liked it so much that they wanted to sing it, that there's something in that song that expresses something that's inside of them as well, and they want to see if they can use it as a vehicle to have some similar cathartic experience, you know, saying it to someone else or performing it so other people can hear it. And that's really amazing. It makes me feel really good, like I made something that is bigger than me.
So with the Compulsive Gamblers, the Oblivions, you know, there are other songwriters involved, but with the Raining Sound, it seems like this is your vehicle. When the band formed, did you have the music vision in mind, or when you put the other players got together with you, you just sort of by default were the songwriter, or how did it form?
Well, I met Greg Robertson. He had just moved back to town. He's a few years older than me and had been living out on the West Coast and was trying to do music and film stuff, I think, and moved back to Memphis, and we met, and he was saying, you're not, you know, you don't really have a band right now. You want to do something sometime. I used to play drums. I would love to play again. Let's do something. And then he found Jeremy Scott, the bass player, through maybe like some kind of musical exchange online, you know, like bassist seeking band kind of thing. And I think that they just got together thinking, because they were both songwriters, that maybe they could do some stuff together. So through Greg, I met Jeremy, and we had a little trio, and we started playing together. And I think that they, both being songwriters, now, most people would think that might cause a problem or some friction, like, hey, we all want to be able to write songs for this band. But I think they both saw that I had a vision, and also I was writing a lot. Yeah. And also, I had a problem writing with other people at that time. It was not an easy thing for me to write with other people. Everything was so personal that I really needed to just do it myself, start to finish. And they said, okay, well, we like what you're doing. We like your song. So we're just going to put our stuff on the back burner and just do this so that you can be the singer in your songs. And which was really great and amazing. It made me feel that much more supported and appreciated because they weren't pressuring me to make it a vehicle for everybody's songs.
Yeah.
And then right maybe a few weeks before we went in to record the first album, Alex Green had moved back to town from living in Belize with his girlfriend, who was Lorette Velvet, who had been in the Hellcats and stuff. They moved back to town and moved in right across the street from me. I already had time booked at Easley Studios in town for us to record our first Raining Sound album. And I said, well, Alex, you play guitar and keyboard. Do you want to come over and jam with us someday? So he did. And it worked so well. I said, well, why don't you come record this album with us? And he said, yeah, that'd be great. So, you know, with less than a week to go or so before we made the album, Alex joined the band. And I'm so glad that he did, because it really changed the dynamic of the band. Yeah. When you go from a trio of guitar, bass, drums, you can imagine it wasn't that different from the Oblivion dynamically. But bringing a Hammond organ in and then a second guitar really allowed the songs to breathe in a different way.
Right.
And from there out, like the first album doesn't sound like the rest of the Raining Sound albums, because we were adjusting. All the songs had already been written for a trio, and then we adjusted them for, you know, adding organ and a second guitar and stuff to make the first album. But after that, then I could write songs that were specifically for that four-man dynamic. So everything sort of changed after that album.
Well, who is in the band currently? Is it the same guys that play with you on Shattered?
So the guys who played with me on Shattered, that's Mike and Benny and Mikey and Dave Amos, who's played with me on many albums and helped me produce the Parting Gifts album as well as played on it. Those guys all played on the Shattered album, and they also played on the album or EP that came right before that. And also Mikey, the drummer, who also works at Daptone, he just had a baby, or his wife just had a baby. They just had a baby. And especially right towards the beginning of the pandemic, and also Dave, my keyboard player, he has a daughter. There was just, it didn't look like it was safe or doable for me to travel to New York and have all these people with families try to include me in their bubble and make time to rehearse, but to make a record. So I just didn't see that as a possibility. But on the other hand, I had had to go back to Memphis for a month to help take care of my parents. Mm-hmm. And while I was there, the germ of the idea occurred to me that I could make a record with the original lineup of Raining Sound, because they all lived in Memphis. And there was my friend Scott Bomar, who used to have the band Impala. He had a studio, which was also happened to be exactly the kind of format that I like to work in. It's a 1-inch 8-track machine. And so I started kind of putting the idea together of just getting an Airbnb in Memphis and doing the record there, and doing it with all of those people. Alex, his kids were all grown. Same for Greg Robertson, for the most part. And then my bass player, Jeremy, he didn't have any kids. So it just it presented fewer obstacles to making it work during a pandemic and recording a record to work with them. Also, I could spend time with my parents at the same time. So we wound up doing that. So it was the first album that we've made together since Time Bomb High School, really.
And so what you're describing is this album that's due out next April on Merge Records?
It is. It's called A Little More Time with Raining Sound.
Huh. Well, cool. You're kind of completing a circle here. It let's see, Shattered, that's from, I think it's like 2014. So that's about a half dozen years worth of a new song. So is this like, is this your All Things Must Pass? It's going to be like three albums worth of stuff? Or or how many songs on this long player?
Well, I had been writing songs for the last few years, and I had a couple projects that I meant to do. We were going to do another Parting Gifts record, but things that always happen and snafus and projects would get canceled or delayed. And so I did. I had all this material building up. But then after some time in Memphis taking care of my parents and a lot of time alone to think and write, I had a lot of songs come to me all at once. And I thought, oh, I gotta totally write all new material for this. And I did wind up using a couple of songs that had been that I had written previously, but most everything on the record was written in the course of about 2 weeks, in like March and April.
So this new record's coming out next April on Merge, but Merge this past June reissued your 2005 album Home for Orphans, and talking about, you know, we were talking about songs and taking on different lives, and, you know, there's an analogy, I think, between children and songs. You know, you raise them up, you're involved in their creation and so forth. So I really like the title, because it also relates to a lot of the songs on there, because the songs on there, a lot of them were outtakes, right?
All takes or singles, things that were kind of either didn't get used on albums that they were cut during those sessions, or they were singles. So yeah, it was that didn't get as much attention as things that were on albums. So it just seemed like an opportunity to have all of these songs that I thought were, you know, either alternate versions or original material that people had never heard. It was a great way to get them all out there in one LP. And at the time, it was kind of a stopgap because the original lineup of the band had just ended and I had moved to North Carolina. And, you know, I thought, I don't know when I'm going to have another band. I don't know if I'm going to put another Raining Sound together, but Too Much Guitar had just come out and it was really popular. People were really liking it. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, until I figure out what I'm going to do next, I'm going to release all this unreleased stuff. And that was Home for Orphans.
Well, Kix Books, division of Norton Records, has recently published Mind Over Matter, The Myths and Mysteries of Detroit's Fortune Records. It's all about the mom and pop record company of the 50s and the 60s that put out doo-wop and R&B and rockabilly, country, honky-tonk, and even polka and gypsy music. And it's written by Michael Hurd and the late Billy Miller. And Billy, of course, he founded Norton Records with his wife, Miriam. The title song, Mind Over Matter, to the book, the Raining Sound did a version of that tune as part of the Daddy Rockin' Strong, the Nolan Strong and Diablos tribute that Norton Records also happened to issue. And you do like, so the Raining Sound, you guys do a killer version of Mind Over Matter. Tell me how you found out about the Diablos.
Well, the very first record that I found on Fortune Records was a 78 by Andre Williams. And from there, I just had to hear more of whatever that craziness was all about. Now, I don't think it was Bacon Fat because I think Bacon Fat was on Epic. It's hard to remember now because immediately I found the Fortune reissue LP that they had done, or the LP that Fortune put out that collected, you know, a lot of the Andre recordings that he did for Fortune. But then I just started looking for anything that was on the Fortune label. When I was out on the road one time, I stopped in a thrift store and I found a 45, might not have been a thrift store. I think actually it was a flea market, but I found a 45 for Nolan Strong and the Diablos doing I Want to Be Your Happiness that I recorded with the Compulsive Gamblers on the Crystal Gazing album. I just loved it. And so then I started looking for more Nolan Strong and the Diablos stuff and eventually found a copy of Mind Over Matter because that was probably the easiest one to find because it was a big, big hit. And yeah, I just immediately fell in love with his voice, beautiful, high tenor, just kind of ethereal, really. I've never heard anybody who sang like that. I mean, I think Smokey Robinson obviously tried to sing like that, but it's just a really unique sounding voice.
Well, I want to point out, I think it's important to point out here, you guys do a version of the song, and again, I have to say, I think you did a really great version of it, and you're pointing out to some of the things that I would find intimidating to try and cover that song, which is this guy, Nolan Strong, his voice, this high tenor, this ethereal sound. I mean, you have a distinctive voice yourself, but it's not of that sort. No, but I think the really cool thing here is, and I think this is what you're very astute at in doing when you do a lot of the covers that you make, is that you're able to identify things in the songs that play to your own strengths. So the version of the song that you have is not the Diablos. I mean, that's, you know, in its own realm of other worldliness, but you have something that sort of showcases your own strengths. And as a version of the song, you know, it stands alone. It's just the elements are all there in place to make it where you hear it for the first time. You're like, wow, this is really cool. And then, oh, what? This is a cover? You know, where did that come from? And then if you compare the two, I mean, each is really unique and has its own personality. And I think that relates back to what we were talking about earlier with people taking your own songs, like Stop and Think It Over, and then coming up with their own interpretations that wind up, you know, standing alone by themselves.
I think that's really important to when you approach a cover. If there's a song that you really like and you want to try to sing it, then if you're going to make it anything other than just a copy, you have to bring your own voice into it. And the band has to be able to bring their own dynamic into it.
Yeah.
On Too Much Guitar, we covered Hank Ballard and the Midnighters' Get It, which I'm a huge Hank Ballard fan. And I always loved Get It, but it's a slow grind. And we made it a fast song.
Yeah.
I mean, so fast, it was hard to get all the words out. But it just felt like there was something about it that when I sang it, like it felt like it needed to be really fast. you know, that is the way I've always tried to approach covers. I know that I can't be the singer that Nolan Strong was. And I know when I did Carl Perkins' Tennessee, I can't sing like Carl Perkins. You know, I'm definitely have my own way of singing. And if I can get inside the lyric and deliver it with my voice and make it authentic, like it's me saying it, then I know I have a chance of really selling the song.
Yeah.
And there are definitely some songs over the years that I have loved so much. And I figured them out and taught them to the band. And we played them once or twice and never touched them again because I knew that I couldn't do it.
Yeah.
Or it was fun to do it live, but I knew that I couldn't record it.
So following along, we're talking about here with covers, and I wanted to say, you know, reiterate that you've done these really cool covers, and I've always admired this kind of deep music foundation that you've got, and this, you know, goes all the way back to your formative years. So you've got these deep, well-fed roots, and I think those roots, you know, keep the ground fertile for your own songwriting. And with a lot of these, or some of these, anyway, these early rockin' tunes, you kind of got this cool Velvet Underground-ish minimalism that's driving these kind of tunes. Like, you got that eighth note thing happening like on Straight Shooter that we listened to before we started talking today. But often your lyrics have got this poetic lilt to them, and at times they're almost reminiscent of being Dylan-esque, you know? And at least one of those songs to me is Falling Rain off of your most recent Raining Sound album, Shattered. And I want us to go out with that tune, but I'd like you, if you can, recall the circumstances that birthed that baby.
Yeah, so Falling Rain, I love, for me, writing a song. I love the process, but the first thing that comes is the melody. And once I figured out what the melody is going to be, then the melody tells me what the feel of the song is. And that could be something happy or exciting or kind of funny or sad, but the melody really dictates that to me. So in a way that as soon as I have the melody, it's set what the song is going to be about. I just have to find a way to translate that melody into English, you know. Once I have that, I can kind of move forward. And the main part of the song is just this descending. It just keeps descending. It's a D, and it like goes into all these different versions of D down to then you get to like a C and you start walking the C down. So it's kind of sad, but always moving. So it's that kind of thing of like, well, the world is sad, or maybe is really hard for you, but if you just keep moving, just keep put one foot in front of the other and keep moving. So that was kind of the idea. And then I just had to find a way to get that into a lyric.
Yeah.
And I think I did, you know, or at least to the best that I felt like I could really kind of get inside that idea. You know, it's always the melody that dictates what the storyline is.
Well, Greg, thank you so much for talking with me today on our Coolest Conversations.
I really appreciate talking to you as well, Manfred, and it's good to hear about you.
Well, here's the Raining Sound off their album Shattered with Falling Rain in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
You like a car when it's going somewhere past the other side of trouble, where only me and the devil know your name. Well, I saw the scar on the back of your arm. That's when you told me the story of all that came before me and what remains. Roll down your mind before it drives you insane. There's a whole lot more to this story than the sound of falling rain.
With Falling Rain, that was the Raining Sound here in Little Steven's Underground Garage. That track is off their most recent album, Shattered, out on Merge Records. This is the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to the band's frontman, Greg Cartwright, for speaking with me today on our Coolest Conversations. Thanks also to Olivia Callahan for producing our segment. Be sure and join me next time around, when my guest will be Jimmy Sons, lead singer and frontman for the 60s band, The Shadows of Night.
They're the ones that had the big hit with Gloria back in 1966. Jimmy has kept the band together off and on over the ensuing years, but recently reunited with original guitarist Jerry McGeorge. And together they've recorded and released a new single out on Wicked Cool Records called Wild Man. And we'll talk all about it on our next Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock and Little Steven's Underground Garage.
There's a place in New York where you can walk through the actual front doors of the world's most famous recording studio, Abbey Road. Through those doors, past the Beatles, Pink Floyd, Radiohead, and countless other rock giants. Where can you find those doors? At the Hard Rock Cafe Times Square. The Abbey Road doors and thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock Cafes, Hard Rock Casinos, and Hard Rock Hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.